Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Suddenly this week, the old game show Jeopardy is looking very cutting edge. Millions are tuning in to see a computer named Watson go up against a couple of the winningest champions in Jeopardy history. At the end of night two of a three-night showdown, Watson was thumping the humans. That's pretty exciting and a little scary. This hour on point, machine intelligence, artificial intelligence, and where it's going. You can join the conversation. Have you been watching IBM's Watson play this game? What do you think? Are we history or not? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was Alex Trebek introducing to the nation Watson on Monday night. What viewers saw was an avatar of Watson, basically a screen with a kind of circle changing color in the middle of it, depending on how confident Watson is. The hardware that makes up Watson, the real guts of it, was in an entirely different room. Here's Trebek.
Developed and programmed especially for this moment, making its first appearance on our national television program. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Watson.
With me in the studio now is David Ganek, a research scientist at IBM who leads the Watson strategy team. He works on Watson's algorithms for assessing confidence in possible answers, been very deep in the development of this thinking or this question-answering machine. David Ganek, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Gandik. And with us from New York is Stephen Baker. His new book on the story behind Watson is Final Jeopardy, Man versus Machine and the Quest to Know Everything. Stephen Baker, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, David, first to you. You helped build this baby. How do you think it's doing so far? It's thumping them in the cash summary of, you know, who's ahead. How do you assess Watson's performance so far?
We're really happy so far, but with Jeopardy, it's not over till it's over. And The winner of this match is whoever has the highest point total from two full games. So we have a whole another game to go. And anyone who watches Jeopardy knows it can change in an instant.
Here was one question from last night. Watson even got a pop culture reference right from Saturday Night Live.
Church and State for 400.
A Dana Carvey character on Saturday Night Live.
Isn't that special?
Watson.
Who is the church lady?
Yes.
Okay, I'm stymied. Stephen Baker, you watched a lot of this thing being put together. How does Watson answer a question like that?
Well, Watson, you know, a lot of people think that Watson has a whole repository of answers and that it just digs through those answers and comes up with the right one. What Watson does actually, and David knows this better than I do, Watson does a research project. It's a research project that takes maybe 2 seconds for every question. First understands the English, then goes on this massive hunting expedition, brings back hundreds of possible answers, and then has to sift through them and determine which one it has the most confidence in and whether it has enough confidence in that answer to bet on it.
David Kuntick, you helped build this machine. So when that question was put last night, Church and State for 400, and Trebek says a Dana Carver character on Saturday Night Live, isn't that special? What happens in that great big sort of a room full of computer stuff that lets Watson come up with the answer? Walk us through it.
Right. So it goes through a number of steps. And the first thing it does is it takes that clue and it looks at what are the important terms here? What is the clue even asking for? And it sees that, well, here's a quote. Perhaps this is a quote from the character. It says it sees character. Oh, so perhaps the question is asking for a character. It sees Dana Carvey. So it says, okay, somehow this is going to be related to Dana Carvey. Then what it does is it goes out and does a massive search. So Watson is entirely self-contained, not connected to the internet.
What's it searching then?
It's searching its corpus. And what that is a large collection of documents, the same kinds of things you or I would use. So encyclopedias, thesauri, textbooks, plays.
So as if it's in a split second rummaging through the entire Library of Congress or more than that.
Yes. We have about not quite that much. We have about a million books worth of information in there.
Okay.
And so at that point, it brings back all these documents. That's not enough, right? You can't drop a book on Alex's desk and say the answer's in there.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pull the answer out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when Watson goes to work. And first of all, it does candidate generation. So it looks through all these documents and says, what are some likely possibilities here? And we'll come up with things like Saturday Night Live. We'll come up with other characters Dana Carvey has played, George Bush maybe, the church lady. At this point, it doesn't care what the right answer is. It just wants to make sure that the right answer is there somewhere in the list.
Okay.
So at this point, we do have the right answer in the list, but we don't know it's right.
Well, no, you know you have it, or you think you have it. I mean, Watson makes mistakes.
Oh, it does. So in this case, we did have it, right? Now, okay. It could be the case that we don't even have it in the list, in which case we're not going to get the question right at all.
Right. But assuming it's in there, what happens next?
So now we've
got a bunch of possible answers.
Right. So now we have to do what a human would do in a research project. We have to evidence those answers. We have to go out and see, can we justify this as being the right answer? And the way we do that is we look at things like passages that occur in text. Maybe someone said Dana Carvey played the church lady. Maybe someone said the church lady's famous quote was this. And so we gather all isn't it special? Isn't that special? So we gather all of this evidence together. We have a large repository of analytics which score that evidence. They say, this is how confident I am. So, yes, Dana Carvey played the church lady. Dana Carvey played George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
The church lady said, isn't that special?
Mm-hmm.
George Bush, I'm not so confident, said, isn't that special?
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, we take all of these scores. There's hundreds of thousands of scores at this point, and we weigh them. We weigh how much am I going to trust each of these different dimensions of evidence and come up with a final confidence. And that's really exciting because Watson has a confidence. It has an estimate of how likely am I right on this question. Really important for Jeopardy.
Stephen, when Watson's doing that, and we'll look more at that, how does that compare with what Brad and Ken are doing, the human contestants here? How is that like and unlike the human thought process?
Well, humans can often cut to the chase because we just know things. And so we don't have to go and score thousands and thousands of different ideas. We might think it's just two. It's whether it's Dana Carvey playing George Bush or playing the church lady.
Mm-hmm.
So we can cut to the chase and do much far less work. And we have less capacity, you know, to go through millions and millions of possibilities the way Watson does. Watson basically compensates for its lack of orientation with massive computing power and chasing down every possible lead.
Here was a moment last night, let me ask you about, David, when the question came, the clue for, it was under U.S. cities, and the clue given by Trebek was its largest airport is named for a World War II hero, its second largest for a World War II battle. The category is U.S. cities, and Watson jumps in to answer. Well, I'll tell you what he said, but we've also got some reaction here. We had a microphone at a Boston University campus hangout where a few hundred students were watching. Lots of people are paying attention to this, and you'll hear their gasp when Watson answered that question, Toronto, not even an American city. Here's the response from the crowd.
And the response was?
Toronto. It's not even an American city. So what happened with the system there, David?
Yeah, so that hurt, right? Sometimes we get it wrong, and that was a bad place to get it wrong because it was Final Jeopardy. But what happened there was Watson has learned by looking at past Jeopardy questions that the category sometimes tells you what the type of thing it is. Sometimes it does not. So there are U.S. cities. There are questions in the U.S. cities category where the answer is shuffleboard. There are questions in the composer's category where the answer might be an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always the case that the category tells you exactly what the answer type is.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, Watson had very low confidence in its answer. It was only about 15% sure that Toronto was right. But it was Final Jeopardy, so we had no choice.
Toronto does have some, its airport does have some kind of war hero references.
Exactly.
And
right.
It's Final Jeopardy, so you had no choice but to go ahead with it,
right.
And it went ahead wrong. Stephen Baker, it can, as David describes it now, it can sound sort of obvious. Just put together this massive, incredibly fast supercomputer, feed in all this information, out comes the answer. You followed the development of Watson from early on. I mean, was it so obvious that they would be able to build a Jeopardy-winning machine against humans? We'll see how it finally turns out. But so far, when this project began, Stephen, was that obvious?
No, it was an enormous challenge, and IBM had to pick very carefully because they wanted to pick a challenge that was very, very difficult but also possible. And that's very difficult to calibrate because the one disaster would be that they don't come anywhere close after spending many research years on it. The other disaster would be, let's say they pick something and a solitary hacker using Google and Wikipedia comes up and actually produces just as good a machine. So that, or another company. So they had to pick something that was possible but really difficult. And I'm sure they're all greatly relieved, as am I, because my book depended on it, that Watson is performing as well as it is.
One point, Tom,
I think is really interesting is that Watson, like humans, entertains doubt. And that's a very sophisticated thing to do. It's not sure. And previously, computers were either were sure about one thing, and sometimes they were sure about wrong answers.
You're saying entertains doubt because it looks at different possibilities and it's weighing its confidence. That's a form of doubt.
It's a form of doubt. It's a lot like learning a foreign language. Watson lives in an utterly foreign language, and it's not sure it understands things. And so for me, it's like Watson is in, let's say you've learned a little bit of an Eastern European language, and the waiter tells you that it sounds like the waiter's saying that there's a dog on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not sure you understood. Did you misunderstand that he's saying something that's not dog, or do they eat dogs in that country? You're not sure, and so you've got a certain level of confidence that you understand dog. And Watson, that's the way Watson is with a lot of things.
David, is this artificial intelligence? You call it a question and answering machine. Is this AI, or is this a piece of AI now?
Well, we think it's a piece. It's a corner of AI in that this can answer questions. Now, that's a pretty big deal. It is a big deal. And it's incredibly challenging, and we have to use the latest technology in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Where it differs from what you or I can do is you can't pick it up and then have it do something completely different, like play a different game, play charades or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a single-purpose application.
It's designed to answer questions. Those can be Jeopardy questions. Those could be different kinds of questions.
And yet single-purpose applications, Jeopardy or otherwise, can be incredibly potent. I mean, already different kinds of artificial intelligence are driving stock market trades. They're driving what the GPS answers. They're doing all kinds of things.
Right. And what's exciting about this is going beyond that because it's accessing what we call unstructured content or natural language. It's accessing things that people write. Because think about how information is transmitted in text, in language.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about IBM's Watson playing Jeopardy in the future and reality right now of artificial intelligence. David Gandek is with us. He's a research scientist at IBM on the team that helped create Watson. Stephen Baker is with us. He's written a book, Final Jeopardy, Man vs. Machine and the Quest to Know Everything, all about the backstory of the development of this remarkable Jeopardy player. For a generation of Americans, the face of artificial intelligence came from Stanley Kubrick's film, 1968 film, 2001, Astronauts Out on a Mission in a Spacecraft Controlled by a Sentient Computer, HAL. But HAL goes rogue and begins to kill off the ship's human crew. Here's a bit of it.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, HAL?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
That was then Stanley Kubrick's 2001. This is now. It's not exactly HAL, but here's a crowd of a couple hundred people gathered at MIT Monday night to watch the television broadcast of Jeopardy. A lot of laughing at Watson answering the clues. Supportive laughter, I'd say, in general. But in this one, Alex Trebek references an evil character from Lord of the Rings.
Wanted for general evilness. Last seen with Baldur. It's a giant eye, folks. Kind of hard to miss. Watson?
What is it? Sauron?
Sauron is right. And
what is Sauron? Here's a sophomore at Boston University looking out on this AI future. Christy Gamble was watching Jeopardy with some other folks. She said she finds watching Watson on Jeopardy exciting and frightening.
It's definitely the future. That's not a question. And it seems like there are a lot of really interesting applications, really great applications for this sort of technology. But at the same time, I mean, sort of blurring the lines of, you know, what it means to be human. And I think that sort of makes us uncomfortable.
Blurring the lines, maybe, a little bit here of what it means to be human. I want to bring our listeners right in here. John in New York. Jay, New York. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I saw 2001. I saw the program last night. I'm not intimidated by the machine.
All right.
It has its speed. Give Watson a second pause and let the other guys catch up and let their computer heads work up and they'll come out even.
So it's got speed. We'll talk about that. But are you not impressed that a machine can come up with these answers?
I give all deference to the geniuses that put this together. I think it's wonderful. I appreciate the brilliance of it. but I'm not intimidated by it.
Right. On the winning side, it's all about speed. You're not intimidated, but it does have that speed. I guess the question here may be around fairness in a way, but let's look at that. Stephen Baker, you write that there was some real back and forth between IBM and Jeopardy over exactly how the game would be set up to make it fair. Give us some of the backstory here that will help us, and then we'll go to David on speed. But what about just the arrangements behind the scenes here?
There was fear on both sides of these negotiations throughout because IBM worried that, first of all, they worried that Watson would lose and make a fool of itself and embarrass the company. And they wanted Watson to have every chance to use all of its abilities to win the game. And the Jeopardy people are looking at this machine that was basically a fool 4 years ago and has now become a super competitive Jeopardy player. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, you know, technology keeps getting better and better. By January, this machine might trounce people and it might be boring and bad entertainment. Mm-hmm. So there was a battle between science and entertainment throughout. And it was fun to watch.
Part of that came down to exactly how Watson would respond. Jeopardy ended up saying, it can't just give an electrical impulse saying it's ready to answer. It has to actually have a robotic mechanical finger that hits a button. Is that right, Stephen?
Yes, it's right. And initially, there was some resistance at IBM to this because Watson was kind of emailing its buzz in. And they had a bunch of data based on Watson's original setup. And then all of a sudden, they had to add this finger. And David Ferrucci, who is the chief of the team, was saying, this is like creating the Frankenstein monster. We built a brain, and now they're making us add a finger, and it's grafting human limitations onto our machine. But I can tell you, I'm betting that IBM is very happy that Jeopardy imposed that right now because Watson is very fast, even with its mechanical finger. And if it didn't have it, people would be crying that it's unfair.
Let's talk about that speed, David Gottlieb, and who's intimidated and who's not here maybe. First of all, just on the way this works, I mean, we hear the question, we see it, and we hear it read in the show. Now, is Watson actually hearing anything, or does it just get the text delivered to it?
So that's right. Watson is deaf, doesn't hear anything going on in the game. It is delivered the clue electronically at exactly the same moment it's displayed on the screen.
So the same moment that it comes to the human eyes, it's going to Watson's brain.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And then Alex is reading the clue. While Alex is reading the clue, no one can buzz in.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as Alex finishes, the buzzer is opened, and then all of the contestants race to see if they can buzz in first.
Give us a sense of the computer that sits behind this speed. Just how big a deal is this? How does it compare, I don't know, with the biggest computers at the Pentagon or NASA or, you know, the particle accelerator? I have no idea. Where's it rank?
Right. So it's a big computer. It's probably on the order of about 1,000 desktop PCs, a few thousand desktop PCs. But it's commercially available IBM technology. You could buy one of these machines.
Mm-hmm. When our caller says he's not intimidated by the speed, when we get into thinking and answers, or at least answering and answers, speed matters. What do you think about this question?
I think that's right. I think that's one reason why we really like the Jeopardy challenge, was because we want to be able to respond quickly. It doesn't help you if it takes us 2 hours to come back with an answer. And so that made us focus on coming up with answers fast. And for us, it's a huge computation we're doing. It's not just pushing the buzzer. We have to come up with this answer somehow, doing this mm-hmm. very complex computation. So it was an enormous accomplishment to get it down to about 3 or 4 seconds.
Making it that fast, it's not as if it were easy, even though it's a computer. Omaha, Nebraska, Tom is calling. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my question.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what is the core kernel that Watson runs? Does Watson have its own operating system or core kernel, or is there another operating system or kernel running Watson and giving the ability for the logic to be entered in? Also, what language are you actually writing Watson's logic with?
Great, Tom. Thank you very much. David, get wonky with us for a second. What exactly is in there running this?
So Watson is actually written in a number of languages, but the real key here is that we use UEMA, which is a framework that we built that keeps track of all of Watson's evidence and how it's analyzing it.
Is UEMA something I can buy off the shelf and throw into my PC?
It's an open source IBM framework. You can download it right now.
Okay.
And then on top of that, we built special...
Boy, will I be smart tomorrow.
On top of that, we built some special question answering technology, which we call Deep QA, and that does all of the work of answering these questions.
So this is software that's open source software from IBM, but elaborated for this particular function.
Right. So the UEM is the underlying layer. Now, the real heart of the question answering is in this deep QA software, which is still in research, and we're still developing it.
Deep QA. I want to ask you about what other applications that may have. We've got a lot of people online wondering about that. But right now we have with us one of the human contestants from this great standoff. Joining us from New York is Brad Rutter, biggest all-time money winner ever on Jeopardy! Won more than $3.25 million in two cars on Jeopardy! Now he is one of those humans up against the computer. Brad Rutter, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. What's the difference? You've competed a lot on Jeopardy! What are you thinking when you're up against a computer? What's the difference? How's it feel? What's different in the contest?
Well, Watson is faster on the buzzer than I think it's safe to say any human is, and that's such a big part of the game that it ends up affecting it quite a bit.
So are you sitting there trying to rev up your mind and your finger to, I mean, are you thinking more about answering the question or speed to hitting the button?
Well, with the question for me, it's sort of automatic. I either will know pretty much instantly whether I want to buzz in or not, and then it's all about timing it. You're not allowed to buzz in until a split second after Alex is done reading the question. And if you come in early, you get locked out. Watson, on the other hand, will never come in early because it's tied to when the system opens up, and it'll hit in a millisecond if it wants to buzz in. So it is possible to get in. I did it a few times, but it's very difficult.
So it's almost a physical challenge as much as a mental challenge competing with Watson here.
Right, and I sort of liken Jeopardy to sports in a lot of ways. People want to see the inherent drama of the competition, but yeah, there is a definite physical element to it.
Do you think it's a fair competition, given the way Watson responds, you know, at the ready moment, compared to how humans respond?
Well, I think what balances it out is that Watson, the hard part for Watson is figuring out what information the question is looking for. That's instantaneous for any human. There are a few categories that might be a little tricky, but any human is going to get the puns and word twists that might come up, but that Watson has a hard time figuring that kind of thing out.
But Watson's winning right now. We've got questions for you. Shira, calling from Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Brad Rutter. Thanks for calling, Shira.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well.
I saw Jeopardy! Last night, and one thing struck me at the end of the show. Nobody was smiling. Alex Trebek was sullen, long-faced. Ken looked so anxious that, I don't know. And the other contestant also, nobody was smiling. I think they were all not intimidated, but, like, worried about this. You know, like, what does this mean in terms of the human condition? You know, are we really superior? Are computers going to take over our lives? Where are we? The humans were the underdogs here.
Yeah, I love that question, Shira. Thank you. Brad, you're right there on the front line. What are you thinking about that?
I think we were just looking for the number of the bus that hit us. That's no fun.
It's kind of the same thing, though, isn't it? Are humans getting taken down a peg in this?
Well, I don't think so. I mean,
you ain't winning.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody would watch the show if it was three computers playing against each other. Like I said earlier, it's about the drama of the competition, and Watson's never going to jump up and down if it gets a right answer or smack the podium in frustration.
We get that, but go to Shira's bigger question. If this is a sign of things to come, you know, you're in there in the arena, you're playing it right now. This is man versus machine. Machine winning as of night two. What do you think about that longer term, Brett?
I think that's sort of beyond my pay grade. I'm just a guy who answers trivia questions on TV. But there is some exciting, applications that come to mind. IBM is big on promoting the healthcare aspects of it, maybe assisting doctors with difficult diagnoses. And you could put every piece of medical literature known to man into something like Watson and be able to remotely diagnose stuff and stuff like that. Personally, I'm just hoping that it starts working for my cable company and I can call them up and figure out why my cable cuts out every Sunday night.
Well, maybe next year you'll be able to do that. Brad Rutter, good luck in the final round. We know it's already been taped. We won't ask you what the outcome is, but it's been a pretty impressive contest already. Thank you so much for joining us,
No
Brad.
Problem. I can't tell you who wins, but I can tell you it's a lot closer than it was last night.
Good. Go humans. We're still in the game. Thank you very much for joining us, Brad. Let's get a call here from Highland Heights, Ohio. Ted is calling. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Great program. Great project. My question is, although Watson may be able to win a Jeopardy contest, can it really pass a Turing test? And just for your listeners, a Turing test is an early concept in artificial intelligence. The idea is you put a computer or a person, you don't know which, behind a screen, and you engage it in conversation or a game of chess or whatever. And the contest, or the question for the human is, am I playing against a computer or am I playing against another human? And if you'll notice, when Watson messes up, it messes up in a very characteristic and big-time way. And that's a clue that you're not playing against another human. You may be playing against a computer that works in a whole different way. So while Watson may very well be able to beat me at the game of Jeopardy, I would still know whether or not I was playing against a computer or another human competitor.
It's interesting. Let us look at that question, Ted. Of course, you know, that seemed like the challenge back in the day. Today, if it's trading stock faster than you can, who cares if it's human or machine? If it beats you in the stock market, it still wins and you still lose. But you're right. Here's a little tape from Monday night, one of those kind of glitches that you described. This is when something happened with Watson that probably would not have happened to a human. Watson, and you'll hear it here, repeated an answer after the human had already given it.
The first modern crossword puzzle is published, and Oreo cookies are introduced. Ken.
What are the 20s?
No. Watson.
What is 1920s?
No, Ken said that. Brad.
What are the 19-teens?
Yes, the 1910s. Correct.
Okay, so Ken jumped in, got it wrong. Watson plodded forward with all its supercomputer speed and gave the wrong answer also. David, you helped build it. We'll get to Ted's question, but is this just because Watson can't hear once it's been given the question, doesn't know what's going on between the other players?
Right, so it didn't hear that wrong answer from Ken, so it didn't know it was wrong.
But it was also wrong. What about the Turing test? And whether you'd know if Watson were human or machine if you sat behind a screen. First of all, do you think you'd know the difference? And secondly, does it matter anymore?
Right. So you could definitely tell the difference because Watson cannot converse naturally like a person. It doesn't have a notion of dialogue and can't carry on a conversation. And another thing which would distinguish it is it wouldn't, like the caller said, it wouldn't understand certain things, would make really silly mistakes. But another thing that distinguishes it is in some cases it would know too much. Right, because he would know these obscure facts that no one single person could keep up.
That's
their head.
Weird. That's bizarre. Who would know that?
Right, but that's great, right? Because that means it's complementary to us. It has the skill that we don't have. It knows a bunch of obscure things that you can't keep in your head.
I wonder if we're all going to walk around with a Watson in our pocket one day soon. Maybe. Christine in Medway, Massachusetts. Christine, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I have a comment and then a question. Mm-hmm. My first comment is, unlike the other caller, it totally freaks me out. Absolutely freaks me out. And my question is about how Watson continues to develop further intelligence. We heard that only about 4 months ago, apparently, it was quite a simpleton, and yet come very, very quickly to something that's really performing tremendously well on Jeopardy. So is it gaining its intelligence by self-correcting its errors? Or are humans going in and therefore correcting, okay, we got the answer wrong about Toronto, so the humans are going in and going, we need to tweak this. Or is there some form of that artificial intelligence that lets Watson do it itself? And if it does, that's what freaks me out, because human intelligence is tempered by what we hope would be morality. And computers, unless they're programmed with morality, don't have that. So are we creating a monster that we have no idea where it's going to go?
Christine, I'm so glad for your call. First, the simple question, is it self-correcting? Is Watson self-correcting? If it makes a mistake, do you have to go in and tweak it, or does it tweak itself?
So if we find Watson is making the same kind of mistake, we have to go in. We have to decide what's going on.
So it doesn't adjust its algorithms itself internally without your intervention?
No. During a game, it will try to infer what's going on in this category.
Okay. But could it one day, do you think? Could it be self-correcting?
I don't know. It's something
that's not the shape of it.
It's something we talk about and think about, but right now we have a large team. We have 30 core researchers working on this. We're collaborating with all of our academic partners.
But that leaves it still in human hands.
It's still very much.
To Christine's freaked out angle.
It does not grow on its own. It takes a lot of manual effort and sweat. And
Stephen, you said that there are a lot of folks in AI who actually resent Watson, that this isn't where they wanted artificial intelligence to go. They may not even agree that it is artificial intelligence.
Right. There are some theological debates in AI, and some people are focused on the great dream and vision of AI, which is to build machines that pass all kinds of Turing tests and think more or less the way we do. And Watson, as David has described, is far from that. And in a sense, Watson is less threatening, but also, to some people, it's disappointing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about IBM's Watson playing Jeopardy and the future and reality right now of artificial intelligence. Stephen Baker is with us, author of Final Jeopardy, Man vs. Machine, and The Quest to Know Everything, the backstory of how Watson was developed. David Gandek is with us, research scientist at IBM, a leader on the Watson strategy team, has worked a lot on the algorithms there. David, Stephen, stand by for a moment. Stephen Levy joins us right now from Palo Alto, senior writer at Wired Magazine, had a big article in the January issue, The AI Revolution is On. Stephen Levy, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So everybody's suddenly focused on this because it's on Jeopardy. That's as mass market as you get. You've been looking sort of under the covers here, and you write in your piece, the computers are in control. We just live in their world. What do you mean?
Well, I guess it's been a slow progress of, you know, in the early days of AI, you know, people thought, oh, we're going to have machines that think like humans and, mm-hmm. you know, they'll be, that's for these, you know, computers, be all powerful. And that didn't work so well. They weren't able to tackle that lofty goal right away. So a couple decades ago, some of the younger peoples in AI started working on these other kinds of techniques. Watson's, I think, you know, an example of that, where people used different kinds of algorithms and probabilities and programming techniques and matched them with the massive data processing the computers can do,
right.
And wound up doing intelligent things in bounded domains like playing Jeopardy or chess or flying an airplane. And as it turns out, more and more humans to run big systems rely on these artificial intelligence techniques, and a lot of times we're using systems, you know, just in our everyday lives that are artificial intelligence systems. We don't even notice it.
Give us some examples, Stephen, of where it's already at work all around us. It may not be the initial conception of AI, but it's still pretty darn potent, and as you say, it's working all over. Like what?
Right. Well, a couple. And, you know, in that package in Wired in January, we had a whole article about the fly-by-wire. You know, the airplanes basically are flown by artificial intelligence these days, and pilots monitor them, and if need be, they could take them over. You know, when Captain Sullenberger landed the airplane into the Hudson, it was sort of a collaboration between him and the computers. Google is a great example. Google is an artificial intelligence system that does something that, you know, 20 years ago we would have thought was, you know, absurdly difficult and requiring great intelligence to be able to go through billions of documents and find the ones that answer the question you just asked, in less than a second. So cars, when you know, now you have artificial intelligence built in, when you press the brake, your input is mediated by a system which figures out what you really wanted there.
And you've got, as you write, credit card companies using it to track down fraud, Netflix using it to recommend movies, the financial system using it to handle billions of trades. The thing about it is it's not the way humans think. And you write, you say that we're locked in this dance with, we're engaged in a permanent dance with machines, you write, Stephen, locked
that's
in an
right,
increasingly
right.
dependent
and,
embrace.
And what you note in there in that passage is that, you know, that was part of the key, is that intelligence doesn't necessarily have to operate the way humans display intelligence. Things can be smart when we let them teach themselves how to be smart. But then when we try to, you know, go to the logs and figure out how they do this, it doesn't make any sense to us because, you know, they've figured out their own ways to crack a problem.
David Gandek, with IBM, you say you've got this deep Q&A software behind Watson. What other kinds of applications are envisioned for this? I mean, playing Jeopardy is fun. It demonstrates a lot to us. It shows us a lot. But what about real-world applications? What can you imagine?
Yeah, so I think we're excited about applications that combine the computer strengths with the person's strengths. So things like healthcare, right? There's a huge amount of medical information out there. A patient may have many records. There may be many a lot of data associated with this patient. And a physician may not be able to keep that all in their head at one time. So something like Watson could serve as a physician's assistant and go out and say, well, I'm looking at this. Here are some possible diagnoses to think about. Here are some things you might not have seen immediately, but you might want to be concerned about.
So medical, what else?
Medical is important. We think, I think Brad mentioned call centers.
Call centers could be, so who needs it? I mean, if the computer can answer an awful lot of questions, will we have to type those in, or can I really call and have it hear my voice?
So at this point, we're not doing speech recognition in Jeopardy, but it would be nice to hook that up so that you could just talk to the computer and tell it the problem you're having. And think about Jeopardy clues. They include a lot of slang or little jokes or asides.
Sure.
They don't always use technical language. That's like a call center. A person might not know what is the technical term for this. So we have to be robust. We have to be able to understand all the different ways people can talk about things.
Stephen Baker, is this an inviting way to supplement human skills, or is this intimidating? I mean, you can put it to work in those ways. You could put it to work in security ways. Maybe, for all I know, maybe it is already. Does the CIA have these things, you know, sort of listening and sifting through conversations already? Maybe mine?
Yeah. Well, the thing I think is that we have to think about our own brains and our and what we should store in there while we're surrounded by these smart machines. And Jeopardy itself is an example. If Watson decided to come back on Jeopardy next year and the year after, Jeopardy would evolve, I bet, toward what Brad and Ken are better at than Watson, toward more nuance, more jokes, things that Watson struggles with. And we ourselves are going to have to move like that in our own intelligence towards the areas of idea generation, concept generation, things that humans still are great at, and leave the Watson-like work to the Watsons of the world.
So we're not just competing, Stephen Levy, with the Chinese and everybody else now. We're also competing. We have to migrate our own talents toward the more conceptual and nuanced. I mean, is this going to – let's say – the call center doesn't go to Bangalore. It just goes to the grandson of Watson.
Right. Well, in a sense, some of that's happened already. When you make a call, customer service now, there's this whole period where you're basically talking to the computers, and if they can't solve your problem, then after I don't know how long, we've all been waiting to get in touch with a human somewhere. So, I agree totally. There is going to take a very, very long time, if ever, where the machines will be able to be nimble and detect nuance the way humans do. But a lot of things that do employ people now, a lot of domains are going to be able to be performed by computers. Factories now, and we started this story in Wired by talking about a factory where the whole shelves themselves are moving, and they figure out where the best place to go to fulfill an order is. So a factory now employs many fewer people than a factory before because there's intelligent systems and robots doing a lot of the work that people would ordinarily do.
So if robots do the physical labor and Watson and its offspring do the mental labor, or a whole bunch of it, maybe not the most nuanced poetry ever, but a whole bunch of it, I mean, what's left for humans to do? What about jobs for 300 million Americans? Is that a problem, Stephen?
Of course it is. what we're going to have to do, and the answers to these, get into some degree into the political realm. How are we going to structure our society to have fulfilling work? In the U.S., we've become to some degree a service economy because there's a lot of things that people can do to help other people that computers are so far from mastering that you can't anticipate a time soon where that'll happen. But eventually, and I think it's going to happen slowly, it's going to creep up on us. We're not going to have to be able to sit and have a conversation or a symposium and figure out the answer to this. It's really going to be thrust upon us because, if you look at where we are now, it's the frog in boiling water. We're way down the path already where intelligent systems are doing a lot of the work for us.
Let's go to Noman calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Noman. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Two quick questions.
Yes.
I was wondering, why do we humans feel particularly threatened when when a machine is extending in intelligence and thinking, whereas we feel absolutely comfortable while we are using machines like airplanes and building trains and stuff like that. And the second question I have is, I'm a bit lost about what is the fuss about in terms of a machine or Watson or whatever, because at the end of the day, it's nothing but the intelligent people who programmed that machine.
Yes, and a pretty good gang of them at IBM, but I don't know, part of it may be, Noman, I mean, I don't know what work you do, but what if a Watson shows up that can do half of your job or 75% of your job? Is that a problem, or do you think there's plenty of room for us to move on and do things even more ethereal than computers can do?
No, that certainly is a problem there, but that again is the way the technology and the economy has been developing over the ages. I think we could argue the same thing about the horse buggy and the motor car.
Right.
The economy and the humanity and the people just move on.
Boy, we better get moving to stay out in front of Watson. Thank you for your call, Noman. David Gandick, what about this? How do you think about it? I mean, you're in the catbird seat. You're the guy who's programming the computer. But for people who aren't, maybe the ones who work in the call centers, how should they look at this? Is it a net improvement or just... do we have to figure out a new economic structure so that we can harvest the benefits of this kind of artificial intelligence and not be left starving?
All right. So, you know, at IBM, that's what we're trying to do is help people do their job. We're trying to get them access to this all this information that's out there. And, you know, you think about, like, computer used to be an occupation title. It was someone who sat in a room and did arithmetic all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have spreadsheets that do that. And what do people do? They think about what calculations are important. What calculations do I need to do to make this decision? So it kind of raises the level. It allows the person to focus on their deep understanding.
And what about the person who doesn't have a PhD in AI?
Right. Well, I think, you know...
They better get busy.
Well, actually, you know, I think that this could help people, even if you're not closely related to the computer industry, this could help. Because what, you know, in many jobs, you need to look at information. You need to sift through a lot of things. You need to check stuff.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice to have someone helping you do that?
The future is always exciting and always a little bit scary. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Pete in Norwood, Massachusetts. Pete, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a very interesting conversation. I've been excited about AI ever since Isaac Asimov's short stories and going through to 2001. One of the aspects of it, I just have a comment and a question. And the aspect of it, as you see computers in art, like, for instance, 2001, where the astronaut was speaking in a very controlled voice, which they're trained to do, almost like a computer, versus the HAL paranoid, showing a kind of an emotion, and it goes to other programs like I think it's LISA, and it is a psychology program where it's open-ended, and people respond to clinical psychological questions and the responses that LISA gives. People attribute almost an emotional ability.
Pete, do you think emotion is a strength for humans, Pete, or not?
It just is. It's strictly a part of it. And my question is, will or can a computer actually, combined with artificial intelligence, act in an emotional way, like people.
Let us pick it up. Yeah. Our time is short. David Gondek, what about it? Can emotion creep into the algorithms somehow, or it's just not on the table?
It's not in there at all right now, but, you know, I think that's what's so exciting. That's what's so amazing about people is that they can bring in that dimension, and we still don't know how to do that with the machines yet. There's this emotional understanding you or I just naturally have.
Stephen Levy, there's a caller. I don't have time to get to him, but Michael in Kentucky is saying he doesn't think we should be intimidated. We can always just turn off the power, unplug the computers. What do you say to that, Stephen?
Well, you could turn off your own computer, but, you know, when you put your credit card in, you know, the gas tank, and it says it rejects you because it it figured out by, you know, your previous, you know, credit card uses that, you know, that someone else might have it, that there's a pattern that the computers determine you don't like. Well, you're involved, and I think Google now has, has been experimenting cars that drive themselves. I think that's going to be common.
There's so much embedded already. You quote
the world is changing. Yeah. You can't opt out of the way the world is relying on artificial intelligence for its infrastructure.
You quote somebody saying the computers are in control. We just live in their world. Stephen Baker, what did you take away from following all this? What do you see in the trajectory here? Is it comforting to you, a better human life alongside these computers on the other side, or something else, Stephen?
I like a world full of Watsons because it does the work that I think we're going to find more boring and lets us do more interesting things and frees us up. And I think it's going to lead to all kinds of breakthroughs in medicine and elsewhere, having this type of analytical software. So I think it's a real advance for us.
And IBM, you've watched them work on this. Do you see them hustling right on down the road for other big applications? This is a lot of publicity for them.
Well, I do. And, one of the things I wanted to mention earlier was that IBM really thought long and hard about how to design Watson so that it wouldn't be threatening, so that it wouldn't look like HAL. They spent a lot of time on the avatar, trying to make it unthreatening. So it's an interesting process.
Boy, it's incredible. Whether they have emotion or not, I've watched people watch the game, David, and they attribute emotion to Watson. I've seen people, audience members feeling sorry for Watson when Watson gets the answer wrong.
They do, and I hope they get excited about it too. Science and engineering is cool.
It's definitely cool. It's definitely exciting. Wow, we're on a new beam here. David Gondick with IBM, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Stephen Baker, author of Final Jeopardy. Thank you, Stephen, for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Stephen Levy with Wired Magazine joining us from Palo Alto. Thank you, Mr. Levy.
You're welcome.
Listeners, good luck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.